Hej och välkomna till avsnitt 1044 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser med mig Ronny Berggren och till del 103 i Miserium USA-valet 2020. Super Tuesday den 3 mars 2020 är över, Joe Biden har gjort comeback och Michael Bloomberg har fått sin nådastöt. Här analyserar jag natten tillsammans med den republikanske presidentkampanjstrategen Justin White. Varmt välkomna. Justin White, welcome.
Good to be with you again, Ronnie. Hope you and your listeners are doing well this evening.
Yeah, thank you. Super Tuesday is, it's almost over. They are still counting in California, but it was, it was a real success for Joe Biden, right?
Absolutely. You know, Vice President Biden has had just an absolutely stellar evening. Of course, everyone expected him to do better, given the absolutely stunning victory in South Carolina. And, of course, the somewhat dramatic endorsements from Senator Amy Klobuchar and Mayor Pete Buttigieg and even Beto O'Rourke in Texas, yesterday. But the size and scope of his victory tonight is well in advance of anything I believe even Vice President Biden would have expected.
Yeah, because one interesting thing is that, you know, Biden was quite weak before his, you know, South Carolina victory, and he had no organization compared to Bernie Sanders in Texas or in California, and he had no money compared to Michael Bloomberg, and still he won. He beat them both, basically.
Absolutely, and it goes to show you one of the things that, you know, those of us who watch these things pretty tightly have noticed is that while Bernie Sanders has had some notable success in the first few states, Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada. The other reality is that he was having, success against a field that was incredibly divided. You know, it's a situation where getting a third of the vote delivers victory. Hmm. He's never had, 40, 50% of the vote anywhere. And I have long suspected that the fewer candidates were in the race, the worse Bernie would do. And that's what we're starting to see tonight.
Yeah. Could you say that Bernie was basically saved? Because it's far from over. But, you know, he was saved by the presence of Michael Bloomberg, ironically enough, because, you know, Michael Bloomberg stole votes from Joe Biden. Could you say that?
I mean, I think that's a very reasonable approach. I don't think that, you know, of course, nobody's ever 100%, but I think it's a reasonable statement to say that, you know, at least 75, if not 85% of Michael Bloomberg's voters would have probably voted for Joe Biden. And so we would have seen, you know, even a more successful night for Joe Biden, possibly including, a much better showing in California, for instance.
Yeah. Before we leave Michael Bloomberg, like I said, he had a lot of money, but he also skipped the first few contests like, you know, Iowa, New Hampshire and, you know, Nevada and South Carolina. Was that a mistake for him, or do you think that it wouldn't have helped him even if he had tried to, you know, campaign there?
I mean, it certainly starts to demonstrate, you know, we've seen an attempted strategy like this before by another New York mayor, Rudy Giuliani, who, of course, went down horribly as well. And while he lacked Bloomberg's money, he certainly had a major national profile, especially given September 11th. And, you know, it was just another failure. The truth of the matter is that you have to engage in the contest as it's designed. And while Michael Bloomberg has spent at current record somewhere close to $500 million, he didn't have enough time to prove himself. And the truth of the matter is you do get better as you practice. And, you know, I think by not being on that debate stage at least 3 months ago, if not six, I think he really did himself a disservice by entering late. And while it appears that he will still do better in terms of delegates than some folks who've run, you know, for over a year, like Senator Warren, at that point, you're punching downward, as we'd say.
Yeah. But the really good news about Michael Bloomberg must be that you cannot buy a presidential race, basically. This proves that.
Right. Absolutely. Money alone is not enough. And I do think that that's a good symbol. You know, I myself, as a political operative, have succeeded in defeating candidates who outspent my candidate by as much as 17 to 1. So while money is a important factor in a race, certainly you can't run without any of it. The other reality is that it takes more than money. It takes a track record. It takes a relationship with voters. It takes a message that resonates with a large group of the voters. And you can't just purchase these things, like you can go down to the grocery store and pick up something else.
Yeah. Well, and that is very good news. But if you take a look, back at Joe Biden's resurgence, basically, I would say that it all started with Jim Clyburn's endorsement in South Carolina. Jim Clyburn is the black congressman from South Carolina, and when he supported Joe Biden, things changed. Would you trace it to that endorsement, or would you trace it like earlier?
I mean, I would say that certainly Congressman Clyburn's endorsement magnified the effect and was probably responsible for a lot of Joe Biden's margin in South Carolina. I think Joe Biden would have won South Carolina even without Congressman Clyburn's endorsement. But the fact that he won it by about 30 points, I would definitely say that Congressman Clyburn's endorsement was responsible for at least 10, if not 15 of those points.
Yeah.
So it definitely took it from a victory to a absolute massacre.
Can we say something about, they are still counting in Texas and in California, and obviously Bernie Sanders will win California. I can't think of anything else, but he will not win in the margins that he probably had hoped. And California have a lot more Hispanics than blacks, Afro-Americans. And, do you think that Hispanics can, do you think that they can save him, save Bernie Sanders, and he can win more of them than he can win, the Afro-American vote?
Well, it will be interesting as we advance forward. As far as this evening goes, one of the things that's really evident, and it's a major factor in a few states, is early voting. In some states, you're allowed to vote early as much as 20 days before the election. And in many states, as much as 10 days before the election. And so certainly people who cast their vote 2 and 3 weeks ago, Joe Biden did not do very well there. And Bernie Sanders was able to bank a bit of a lead. Also, Michael Bloomberg was doing much better 2 weeks ago. And so we see in states like Colorado, which is a very mountainous state, and where roughly half the voters mail their ballots in more than a week before the election, Joe Biden actually came in third, still decent enough, and he'll pick up some delegates in Colorado, but his poorest showing of the night. And it's because so much of the vote was cast really 7 to 10 days ago before South Carolina at all.
Yeah, before his momentum.
Right. And also before Bloomberg had really been attacked repeatedly as well. And so Bloomberg did quite well. He came in second in Colorado. And it's his best showing of the night. And so it's Utah follows a similar pathway, although it's not as aggressive as Colorado. Biden will probably wind up coming in second in Utah. But at the same time, it's another one that's a little more troubling because people cast so many of their votes so long ago, relatively speaking. California has a bit of that as well. It's also another reason why Bernie's going to do okay in California. It looks like on the day of, meaning today, the voters who voted in person, Biden just did leaps and bounds better than anyone expected, as much as 5 to 10 points better than anyone expected him to do. So it's really promising. And the other flip side is that those who cast their ballots early, for instance, even in the state of North Carolina, which has a very modest early voting participation rate, something like 7% of the vote statewide wound up going to Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, and Tom Steyer, three candidates who aren't even in the race. So,
yeah. You know, Bernie Sanders, he hopes to win, you know, this, he hopes to build this new coalition with, you know, young people and also Hispanics. But, you know, young people, they have a track record of actually, you know, showing, they can show up at a campaign event, but they don't go to the polls the same way like older people do. Do you think that Bernie Sanders has, you know, overestimated the his new coalition?
I do think he has overestimated it slightly for sure. It's a mixed bag. We see that, you know, now we've got quite a number of states to go on, right? The first four plus the 13 today. So 17 of our 50 states have now voted. So we have a really good picture of who's voting and how much. And certainly there's some variance state to state. But it does appear that young voters are turning out at roughly the same rate they always have. A little bit above in some states, actually a little bit below in some states, which is interesting. And likewise, Joe Biden actually won the young vote in South Carolina. So it's not enough to just say that someone's under the age of 35 or so, and therefore they're with Bernie. You know, the odds nationwide lean that direction slightly, but it's only by about a 5 or 10 point margin. Whereas then, if you go to voters over the age of 65, Joe Biden is winning that by 30 and 40 points. So it's, you know, Bernie's margin among the young is a bit overstated. You know, the other reality is, as we look forward, you know, a Hispanic vote will matter more than it has up to this point, including California, because of course we still have significant Hispanic votes in Arizona and New Mexico. There's also a reasonably strong Hispanic vote in Florida, and also still a decent amount of Hispanic vote in Louisiana. But as we, and also in some of the more developed states like Ohio and Michigan and Pennsylvania, but I think that the African American vote, certainly in states that haven't voted yet, such as Mississippi and Louisiana, as well as Kentucky and Missouri and Michigan. You know, I think that Bernie Sanders has got a tall hill to climb. It's interestingly enough, it appears that Elizabeth Warren is definitely going to stay in, despite what has got to be an abysmal night for her, including coming in third in her own home state, which is just shocking, to be honest. And but she stays in, and I think one has to believe that the majority, although perhaps not as one-sided as Bloomberg's voters, but the majority of her voters would definitely vote for Bernie over Biden. So that's definitely a negative for Sanders as well. Whereas Bloomberg's spokesman has announced he's going to do some consideration and have an announcement tomorrow, because he, of course, has just done horribly considering the staggering amount of money he's spent.
Yeah, but why do you think that Elizabeth Warren will stay in the race? What is her motives to do that?
Well, I think that Senator Warren is unique. Some people would call her egotistical, or worse, but she's in the unique situation where she's not up for personal election again till 2024 in her Senate seat, so it costs her nothing, and she has a great deal of time to recover, both in terms of voter awareness and fundraising for her next race after this. So there's very little keeping her from staying in from a practical standpoint. The other reality is that, you know, while she has done quite poorly this evening, the truth is she's picked up more delegates tonight than she has previously. By coming in third or fourth in certain states, she's still likely to, you know, pick up somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 40 delegates, which, compared to the 400 or 500 that Bernie and Biden will get, is pretty paltry. But at the same time, it does eventually potentially put her in a situation where she's come in, you know, fourth or even third if Bloomberg drops out. You know, she might stand to, you know, come in with enough delegates that if a brokered convention happens, it would give her a real seat at the table.
You mentioned a broken convention. Is that, you know, that sounds a lot more realistic now, because, you know, Bernie Sanders didn't really lose. He didn't win, but he didn't lose either. So it really looks like that can happen.
Yeah, so currently, and of course, there are still So, in addition to winning the states, perhaps your listeners are aware the Democratic Party has a very unusual system. So they will be awarding delegates based on these votes, but it's not a winner take all, which is often what the Republican system is for the same style. So even though Joe Biden might come in second or Elizabeth Warren comes in third in a particular state, as long as they receive 15% of the vote, they get some delegates. So by the same token, if you win a state but you say you beat your opponent by 1%, it's very possible that you only get a couple more delegates than they do, even though you can claim that you won the state. It sounds good, but in terms of delegates, it's not worth much in terms of difference over your next closest opponent. So what's interesting is it looks like Bernie Sanders' only significant victory today will be in California. And out of California, he probably will get somewhere around 50 to 100 net delegates over, say, Joe Biden. But the flip side of that is Joe Biden's victories were so considerable in states like Virginia and North Carolina and Tennessee and Alabama that it completely wipes out whatever gains Bernie received in California. And so we're looking at a situation where at the end of the night, or perhaps even to be honest, tomorrow, when all the delegates are apportioned, as is still going on, and you can see that in a side tally this evening, it's likely that, Joe Biden may wind up with maybe 30 or 40 delegates more than Bernie Sanders for the night. But of course, Bernie had about 50 or 60 more than Joe Biden as of yesterday. So it's very likely that they will be statistically tied in delegates tomorrow. And with neither one having the majority, of course, because of Mayor Pete and Amy Klobuchar and Senator Warren also, and even Mike Bloomberg having about another 100 or 150 delegates between them. So, so the brokered convention at this point still looks quite plausible. However, if Mike Bloomberg decides to get out of the race, then I think Joe Biden has an opportunity. What remains to be seen, of course, but has an opportunity to actually close this thing out before the convention. But if he stays in, then I think a convention fight is quite likely, actually.
Yeah, we can just mention that you need to have 1,991 delegates to actually just win in your own power. Otherwise, it goes to a brokered convention.
That's correct.
Yeah, but I was thinking about Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar when they in the last hour basically said that we're gonna drop out of the race before Super Tuesday and we're gonna endorse Joe Biden. Do you think that what was the reason for doing that? Was it just like that they realized that Joe Biden is the only way to stop Bernie Sanders, or was it like what reasons were there for they not to stay in, especially for Pete Buttigieg, who actually had some strong performings, not to stay into Super Tuesday?
Well, and that's a very interesting question. So in the case of Senator Klobuchar, she did just horribly in South Carolina, finishing sixth. And there really was no pathway forward for her. While she had a decent showing in New Hampshire, finishing third, at the end of the day, a third place finish is nothing to shout to the tops about, especially in a second state after she finished, fourth or fifth even in Iowa. So she got enough money to get her to South Carolina and through Nevada, but she also finished, in fifth place in Nevada. And it's just there was really no future for her campaign. She was just going to make a fool of herself, frankly, if she continued. And her campaign had so little money that it made sense for her to retire with a bit of dignity. Now, Mayor Pete's a more interesting case. Mayor Pete is in a situation where he's technically out of a job, whereas Senator Klobuchar, no matter what happens, is a U.S. senator for at least another 2 years. She's not up for re-election until 2022, so she has time, and she sits in an important committee, and she's done very well in her state, so she's very likely to be re-elected as long as she runs a decent campaign, which she's always done in Minnesota. But if she were to lose Minnesota or even come in third or fourth, much like Senator Warren in Massachusetts, then it starts to damage her brand, so to speak. So it makes sense for her to get out. Mayor Pete's a very unique situation. On the one hand, he had nothing to lose because he's unemployed currently, other than his run for president, as he's finished his term as mayor of South Bend in January. However, the flip side of that is he's also only 37 years old. So whereas Senator Klobuchar is in her late 50s, you know, Pete has a 30-year, if not more, career ahead of him.
Yeah.
And so he needs to be strategic in thinking about what the consequences will be a year, two, five, 10 years from now of his actions. By quitting now, he has an additional benefit. Unlike Senator Klobuchar, his campaign was not broke. While it certainly was not as strong as it was, you know, a few weeks back, because, of course, he'd spent quite a bit of money in Nevada and South Carolina and not done terribly well in South Carolina, especially. The other reality is that he still has somewhere between $5 and $10 million in his campaign account. Now, on Super Tuesday, that would probably have bought him a couple of third place finishes, possibly even a second place finish in one or two states, but with no likelihood of victory. And in also perhaps empowering Bernie Sanders in the process, which he certainly doesn't seem to have wanted to have done, but especially given his endorsement of Vice President Biden. It also means that he has enough money in his campaign accounts that he can switch that money to a U.S. House of Representatives race or even a U.S. Senate race in Indiana. And without question, he would become the Democratic nominee without competition. And he could probably bury any opponent for U.S. House with that amount of money. And it would go a long way in a U.S. Senate race in Indiana, which is a more rural state and doesn't have the high dollar spending of a Florida or a New York or Texas. So he's given himself enough financial ability to run a very serious run for office in the future without having to raise any money, you know, off the bat, which is smart for a man who's under the age of 40. Additionally, I think he's acquitted himself incredibly well during the debates and town halls. People fundamentally like him in a way that they people fundamentally liked Mike Huckabee. I know a number of Republicans and conservatives who don't hate Pete Buttigieg, very similar to the way Governor Mike Huckabee often had Democrats say nice things about him because he seemed like a kind communicator.
Yeah.
And so Pete has a brand in that regard as well. And at the end of the day, you know, if Vice President Biden is the nominee, which seems very possible, he has to pick a running mate. And Mayor Pete could certainly have, it would almost certainly be able to count on being on that short list and may very well wind up the vice presidential nominee.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. You know, in the Bernie Sanders camp, they often say that, you know, the establishment of the Democratic Party is trying to, you know, to stop him. And you have what you have seen now is that they have coalesced around Joe Biden, you know, Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg and so on. But you know, this theory that, you know, the Democratic Party tries to stop Bernie Sanders, is there any truth to that at this race? I think it was more true in 2016, but do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that in 2016, Hillary Clinton had basically taken over the DNC, and therefore the DNC's corruption, which has been proven and discussed openly in, like, DNC chairwoman Donna Brazile's book that she wrote on the topic, so it's not a conspiracy theory. The DNC, which was essentially a tentacle arm of the Clinton campaign at times, did do things to harm the Sanders campaign and to cheat them to at least a small degree. But the flip side is also true, right? A party is a party. In the same way that Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden and Amy Klobuchar and Tom Steyer are all Democrats and yet don't agree and we're running against each other, the Democratic Party is not a monolith. You know, the DNC, I think the majority of its members are probably either actively opposing Bernie Sanders because they belong to the Joe Biden wing of the party. And I'm sure there are some that are certainly not with Sanders, but may not be with Biden either. And so they're not going to do anything to help Bernie Sanders, which is, you know, I'm sure that Senator Sanders doesn't like that, but that's not really their job. So far, we haven't seen any corruption. The fact that candidates like Amy Klobuchar or Pete Buttigieg, who actively campaigned against Bernie Sanders and attacked his campaign, are supporting someone who's not Bernie Sanders should not come as a surprise to anyone. They have fundamental political disagreements, and they're going to endorse someone who, they hope beats him. I think that's incredibly transparent. Now, of course, do they hope to possibly have a future in a Biden administration? Oh, of course, that's probable. It stands to reason that Amy Klobuchar might well become the Attorney General of the United States, or Pete Buttigieg might become the vice presidential nominee or some other cabinet position. And of course, this is part of, political horse trading, but it doesn't reach into the realm of corruption. And I think that anyone who thinks the DNC is out to get Bernie in some sort of, organized subterfuge is drinking a little too much Kool-Aid, as we would say.
Yeah, but one person that really tries to to say it like this, that the DNC is trying to rob to steal the election from Bernie is President Donald Trump. He tweets that, he writes it on Facebook, and he says that when he gets the opportunity, and obviously that is just to to disrupt the democratic race. But if we look forward to the general election, assume Joe Biden will become the democratic nominee, and that's a very realistic scenario right now. What do you think will happen? How big chance does he have to defeat Donald Trump?
My personal opinion is that if we were to go back in time 20 years, and I've been involved in politics this long, Joe Biden was often, much like Pete Buttigieg is in the moment, a person who Republicans would refer to as someone who they wish more Democrats were like. Now, obviously, Vice President Biden has become a little more of a partisan by being Obama's vice president and by campaigning for president in the current climate. His bipartisan appeal is certainly going to be diminished by those two facts to a degree. But the truth is, Joe Biden has never come across as a social justice warrior. Joe Biden has never come across as a man who wants to confiscate your guns. He's not someone who inherently infuriates the right or the center right. He's often a very calm, reasonable, fellow, to the point that his nickname in politics is Uncle Joe. You don't necessarily love or agree with everything your uncle says, but he's still family. And so Joe has a bit of that going for him. Whereas, of course, we know that Donald Trump, again, agree or disagree with him, is a polarizing figure. He's not a kind of person people have mixed opinions on. And so with that, a candidate who is able to unite the Democrats, as frankly, I believe almost any candidate can, because of the virulent nature of President Trump, and who's also able to make people who were perhaps the kind of voters who voted for Obama in 08 and Romney in 12, or voted for Obama in 12 and voted for Trump in 16. And we know that, statistically speaking, hundreds of thousands of these voters exist. These are voters who are willing to vote for Barack Obama, which means they're certainly not good conservatives or good Republicans. And yet they matter, especially in states like Michigan and Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin and Minnesota. And when you look at those voters, Joe Biden does very, very well with those type of people. He's the kind of Democrat that doesn't make moderate Republicans or liberal Republicans scared or inflamed. Whereas Bernie Sanders, with his talk of socialism, is a great foil for Donald Trump. And as President Trump has made the comment, if you like me, great, but even if you don't, you have to vote for me because the Democrats are crazy. Well, Joe Biden's not crazy. And nobody thinks Joe Biden is crazy. And so if the Democrats are successful in nominating Joe Biden, I would put the odds of him defeating Trump at probably 60 or 65%. I think Donald Trump's in real trouble if Joe Biden's the nominee, although it's far from settled politics, as you know, this far out.
Yeah, very interesting. And you have met both this person. You have met Donald Trump and you have met Joe Biden. What would you say about their personalities? You have just, talked a little bit about it, but is Joe Biden this humble person? He makes a lot of gaffes, and when you watch him talk and hold rallies, he sometimes can sound very, he makes gaffes and he can sound a little bit rude sometimes. But as a person, you say that he's a humble person in person.
I would agree with that, completely. My experience with then Senator Biden and Vice President Biden was one of fundamental genuineness and kindness. I felt like it was certainly more. It was a couple of different occasions. He served alongside a cousin of mine in the United States Senate. They were office colleagues, and so I knew him through that lens first, and met him a few different times. And in every instance, he took more than the, expected amount of time. Of course, when you're introduced, you're going to be polite to someone, especially if it's this right setting, right? And you're going to say hello and it's nice to meet you and all these kinds of generalities. But he would take time and ask me how I was and where I was in school and how that was going and what subject, I loved the most. And the next time I saw him, even though in one case it was more than 3 or 4 years later, he brought it up and asked how things had gone and named the school offhand. And, while I suspect I'm not the least important person he ever met, hopefully, the other reality is, he spent no more than an hour with me over the course of my lifetime. He's certainly not someone who knows me well, nor do I know him well. But he cared enough to remember this young man who I was at the time, that had no meaningful benefit to him. And no likelihood to do anything for him in any short or medium term of time. And it demonstrated real character, a good sort. Now, I will say on the flip side that while Donald Trump is bombastic and plays a bit of a caricature of himself, the truth is that the couple of times I was around him, he was gracious, he was kind. I would say that it was no more so than any gentleman would behave in an appropriate setting. I wouldn't say that he was overly, outgoing or solicitous, but at the same time, I would notice him do things like grab the door for a busboy to help him with the door, and little things that if he were a complete and utter monster, or a mean-spirited person, that those are little touches that show that he has a little bit of grace, for whatever the reason may be. So in both cases, I don't feel that either of these men are bad people. I just think that Joe Biden is perhaps a bit more, puts a little bit more energy, or perhaps a little bit more empathy, to use a word that's being thrown around a lot recently.
If we're gonna look forward to the general election once again, the economy is very important, and the economy is basically the message Trump's talk about all the time. To say that, look at the economy, vote for me, and they talk a lot now about the coronavirus and how it can affect the economy. Do you have any thoughts about that? Can it affect the economy? And if it does, what does that mean for President Trump's re-election?
So the coronavirus in particular is very interesting. As is often the case with mainstream media over the last 10 years or so, every storm is the worst. Every situation is dire, in an interest to constantly keep you glued to your phones and your televisions. So I do think that President Trump and some are not wrong to state that the media has inflamed the situation beyond its present, course. However, some of the media critiqued that the Trump administration was responding a bit ham-handedly or diminishing it as well. I think both can be true. I feel that both are true from my, independent analysis of the situation. Unfortunately, the coronavirus does seem to be many times more deadly than the flu, so it's not anything to be taken lightly or to be scoffed at. But at the same time, it's certainly not Ebola. Or something of this order that kills, a huge portion of the number of people infected either. Western medicine, whether it be in Sweden or France or the US, is certainly, frankly, more capable than that of rural China, if we're just being honest. And so the death rates in China would always be a multiple of what they would be in a Western country with the same exact situation. We do have a good comparator in SARS, which is also originated in rural Asia. And the good news is the coronavirus is less deadly and less transmissible than SARS. So, and we know that having lived through SARS 10 years ago, it didn't kill millions of people. So there's no reason to think that if we're mindful, coronavirus will kill millions of people either. The time of millions dying from things like the Spanish flu and, you know, 1903, et cetera, I do think are behind us with some of the medical technology and communication sets we have. All that being said, an interesting sub-element to this is trade. The fact that the U.S. has gone too far, as Donald Trump has spoken of, and many other political leaders over the last 10 to 15 years, has gone too far in relying on China as a key partner in our supply chain. And I do think that over the next 3 to 5 years, we'll see significant reconsideration of labor pool sources, perhaps back to Latin America rather than China, as a means of addressing that in terms of future factory buildouts, which could potentially lead to some medium-term economic impacts on China, certainly over the next 10 years. And so I do think that will be actually a lasting legacy of this, well, long after the hundreds or unfortunately thousands of people who have died and hundreds of thousands of people who will be infected as we go through this process of coronavirus are long healed or forgotten.
Yeah. But the short-term effects that, you know, and the presidential election, will it affect the economy in the short term and make it harder for Trump to say that, you know, look at the economy and re-elect me?
Well, it'll be interesting. You know, of course, our stock market is taking quite a beating over the last week and a half, down roughly 12%. That being said, there are many people, and I would be one of them, frankly, who thinks that our stock market was already a bit overvalued. So possibly it's just a solution in search of a problem, in the sense that something needed to take the stock market down 10%, and it might as well be this kind of thing. And of course, we know that stock market trends can trigger additional economic trends, but there's no cause and effect relationship that's one to one. So I think as long as everything else stays normal and we don't have any issues with credit crises or military, related situations, then I think that this will be ultimately a bit of a pause, but no real significant decline coming from it. Obviously, that changes dramatically if the number of cases of coronavirus go from the, 50 to 100, which we currently have in the U.S., to 100 times this many, and we start looking at things like school closings and shopping mall closings to prevent, congregation of large number of people, sporting events, concerts, et cetera. You know, then, of course, I do think we're dealing with something that could threaten the president and his administration, as well as the economy at large. But I think we're, weeks, if not months, away from such a thing. And my hope, and it does appear, that in all practicality, that those kinds of severe issues will be thwarted and will be a non-concern. But, we'll know in the next 6 or 8 weeks, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. Well, to summarize, we can say that Joe Biden had a really good night. He basically won Super Tuesday. You know, Bernie Sanders didn't lose, but Biden won. And, he looks like the presumptive nominee, at least.
Well, I won't go so far as to say presumptive nominee. I do think there's quite a protracted battle ahead. And I do think that Bloomberg may well wind up shaping it, not as he intended, perhaps. But if he chooses to get out, I do think that it's fair to say Joe Biden's likely to win. If he stays in, I still think it's quite muddied water. But one thing is very clear. Joe Biden has gone from a man on critical, alert to a very solid co-front runner with Bernie Sanders, absolutely. And we're definitely going to see a protracted battle for at least the next several weeks, rather than the route that Senator Sanders was looking possible towards just the 2 short weeks ago.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot for taking time, Justin. Thank you.
Absolutely. It's good to speak with you, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Det var avsnitt 1044 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser, Sveriges enda konservativa podcast om USA, som kan stödjas på swishnummer 070 30 28 95 0 eller genom att via hemsidan stödja på PayPal, Patreon eller bankkonto. Ni kan också stödja genom att dela podcasten och inte minst den här serien om USA-valet i sociala medier och i andra sammanhang. Det var allt för idag. Tack för att ni har lyssnat. Thank you.